If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Welcome to the Dear Lovejoy podcast, and today it is a special. Today's conversation is with Ian Brody from Lightning Seeds, who everybody knows. He's such a great guy. He's been around for such a long time. From Liverpool, obviously we all know Lightning Seeds songs like Pure. Life of Riley. Yes, Life of Riley, which used constantly, wasn't it? Lucky You's a good one. Life of Riley was used on football, which match of the day, wasn't it?
Always goal
of the season. Dun, 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 dun. Well, not very good at singing.
You have to play him to PRS. That was so uncanny, Tim. You might get charged for that.
He also produced a lot of music from the likes of Echo and the Bunnymen, The Four, Marky Smith, The Coral, The Zootons, The Subways, Terry Hall. He wrote with Terry Hall.
Who's that?
Oh, Mark. Terry Hall, along with the Specials, invented music. And obviously famously known for...
Is he the guy out of Hall & Oates?
Mark. we talk about Terry Hall, actually, in the podcast. But he wrote Three Lions.
Oh, no, he was married to Mick Jagger, wasn't he?
Mark. He wrote Three Lions, which is what we start on, because resurgence last summer in the World Cup. Everybody loves it. And basically, Mark and myself, while setting this podcast up, have just been singing Three Lions constantly to ourselves, haven't we? It's the song which sticks in your head, and now you can't get it out for the rest of the day. It's brilliant. Conjures up a lot of emotions for me, that song.
Yeah.
Not just football, but everything surrounding
when it came out at the time and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, when it came out at the time, stuff I was going through emotionally, and then subsequently every other time it's come out, it's just one of those great songs which conjures
it's
up a
so
moment in time.
Good.
It is. And Ian's such a lovely bloke, isn't he?
Oh, he was so nice. And of course, being a Liverpool fan, I could have chatted to him for ages.
By the way, people who are not fans of football, this does start off a bit footbally, but it moves on. It's not a football podcast, and then it goes back to football at the end.
It is bookended by football, but it's not much. I would say it's 7 to 8% of the interview.
It's a nice romp around the music industry. Let's meet him. This is Ian Brody.
This is just a guide to modern life. Modern life is hard to get just right. It can frustrate you and annoy. And if it does, right into Dear Lovejoy.
Ian, welcome to my kitchen. Thank you for coming today.
Thank you. Very nice kitchen too.
I know you got a bit of a cold, so I apologise. Well, I don't apologise for it, but thank you very much for coming.
It's not your fault.
It's not my fault, no. I bought you a present. I buy everyone a present. And hold on, let me get my present. It's a loud present. I bought you kombucha. And do you like kombucha? I don't really know a lot about it, but I was a bit worried about, because you're rock and roll, I didn't know whether to buy you alcohol or not, because I didn't know whether you'd drunk still.
What is kombucha?
Kombucha, right. Kombucha is a fermented, slightly alcoholic, as in it's not alcoholic, but it feels lightly effervescent, sweetened black or green tea drink, commonly intended as a functional beverage for its supposed health benefits. So I went to a health shop today and I saw, do you still drink, by the way, or not?
I do still drink.
Oh, do you? Because I keep buying people alcohol and then they go, oh, I don't drink anymore. So I get worried. So I thought I bought you something healthy instead.
Fantastic.
But I bought you that.
And it looks like apple juice, doesn't it?
I bought two bottles. So I bought a little bottle so we could try it, the three of us.
So an unnamed bottle.
That's, yeah, because it's...
I'm going to drink it. So it's got nothing whatsoever on it. I'm going to drink it.
Looks a bit like a urine sample.
That is a leap of faith, isn't it? Trust.
But I got it from the health food shop, and it's Mark. There you go. That's
on Haight Ashbury.
It's kombucha. It's all the rage these days. It's in all.
Okay. I'm
going to tell you what flavour I bought us, by the way, because you can have a look. What do you think?
It is effervescent.
The flavour is Thai. I bought Thai flavour, and it's lemongrass ginger, kaffir lime leaves, turmeric, and Galangal. So that's it. It's all healthy. How are you feeling?
It sounds like it should be really healthy. Slightly effervescent. A little bit sweet for me, but, you know.
Not sure about that.
It's like a
yeah, it's like, oh, what do you think?
It's a little bit like drinking incense, I'd say.
Well, you've got a whole bottle to take
Not
home.
Not that I drink incense regularly, but...
sadly, you have to take that home.
I swear I drink.
give it to Riley. He'll like it. He's young and he'll find that exciting. Right, let's go straight into talking about Three Lions. Why don't we? I just bumped into you not so long ago, actually, didn't I? And we were just, the first thing which came up, I went, I can't believe how big the song became again. How exciting was that for you last summer?
It was great. It was great because probably like everyone else, it was just such a great World Cup and it was the heat wave and everyone was singing Three Lions. So it was on many fronts. It just felt, and there was a great vibe in the country. And so, it was just, I really enjoyed the summer. I love the World Cup. I do love the World Cup. I like it much more than sort of any of the other international. You know, it's really different to the Euros or anything, isn't it? I just kind of get... It just brings up so many memories of when I was a kid and just the whole thing, you know, Brazil.
Because we actually believe we could win, didn't we? I know all the Scottish people listening to this will be laughing now, and the Welsh and the Irish and everyone else. But we actually started thinking, we can win this. We're all looking all right. We've got a great route in.
Well, it did feel like the gods were giving us a pretty, football gods were giving us a kind of a nice path through. They were like, here we go. Go on, this way, you know, come this way. And in the end, when we lost, half of me felt like I wasn't expecting anything at the beginning. So, and it was brilliant. And half of me felt like, wow, we've just blown an amazing opportunity.
Yeah.
So it was kind of that mixed feeling. But I suppose, if you get to the semi-final of anything, you know, if I'm supporting Liverpool, and you feel that way, don't you? It's like, it could have been, and will we get this again or whatever. But I mean, I think sometimes you just have to enjoy the ride, don't you? And I did.
It's good at the moment, the England team, isn't it? Even we're going, after the tournament, Gareth Southgate's doing a great job, isn't he? We actually can get behind our team for once.
Yeah, I think there's just a good vibe. I'm always a bit confused. In between competitions, I never, because we always seem to be good in between competitions.
Yeah.
So results-wise, I never really take that very seriously. But it does seem like... there's a bit of a plan and they all seem to quite like it there and they seem a bit relaxed. So I just think on that level, you know, they're all good players and it's been more of a mystery why all these good players don't kind of play well for years, isn't it? You know,
well, our clubs don't play them. That's why actually your club does, mine doesn't. So my club develops all the young talent and refuses to play them. I mean, oh God, being a Chelsea fan's tough. It kind of is because you can't. I don't want this to be a football podcast, but you can't. We've never had any youth team players come through. You're never buying into any players. You're always importing them from somebody else or buying other people's champions or whatever. It's just weird.
Yeah, I think if you do want, it's kind of, I always think, obviously, Mourinho synonymous with Chelsea, even though he's at United. And it is that thing of Mourinho was known for instant results. And I think Chelsea, it's a bit like that's the psyche. So you're not going to have a youth thing because you want the result now.
City, yeah. It's the same thing. Whereas you look at Sir Alex Ferguson, how amazing he was, because he used to have all the young kids come through and he always blood young talent constantly. Some worked, some didn't. But then he'd buy an Eric Cantona or Ronaldo or...
Different times though. Really, really different times. You know, I mean, I just think that's like saying, you know, who's better, you know, Bobby Moore or, you know, someone from now. I can't even think of it.
All right, let's get... Well, what does it make you feel like when you hear the fans singing Three Lions then?
I'm always pleased. Yeah, I'm always, pleased. It's really good. I mean, to be honest with you, I like it when it's not associated with England as well, because it I think sometimes, you know, like in the summer, there were loads of Russian fans singing it in Euro 96. I know people get a bit funny about it. There were German fans. There's been Dutch teams have asked, could they change the words and have it for their club? And I'd love it to become to be honest, I'd love it to become a football song anthem, that could be adapted, you know. I mean, because I suppose all those songs start off with a club and then some of them become just football.
Talk us through the process then. How did that actually happen? Remind us.
The process, as in once, you know...
You and how you and Frank and David and it all came about. How did it all happen?
I think, well, you know, it's funny because this summer there were loads of people I've never heard of in the papers saying that they put it all together. Mentored me, pretty much wrote the tune. And I was like, who is this? Oh, okay. And I suppose, you know, success has many fathers, but I think originally, you know, it is that funny thing. It's, I always think with music and with bands, people discover bands or people have an idea, and it is, it's like, I remember there was an advert for Scotland where they said, or no, Ireland, where they said he discovered Ireland, you know, and playing on that thing of, and I suppose everyone discovers something,
yeah,
and five people can discover a band, you know, and it doesn't mean they didn't discover them, they just discovered them after the other guy had discovered them, you know, so so it's kind of a little bit like that. And I don't really know whose idea it initially was, but when I was asked to do it, I thought it was a bad idea and I didn't really fancy it. So I sort of said, oh, no, I don't want to do that. You know, I don't really want to do that. And then I had to sort of think about it. And I was watching fantasy football, really. And I thought, you know what? It might be quite fun if these guys fancied doing it and I wrote something, and that could be quite, you know, it could be quite good fun, and it would be a bit, something a bit away from what I'm doing, a little bit, a project sort of thing. So that was how it initially came about. I sort of contacted them and said, do you fancy doing this? And then initially people were like, why are you doing that? You know, that's not, you know. And then we got together and we had a chat about it, and we had a similar idea about if we were going to do something, the things, more the things we didn't want it to be than the things we did want it to be.
Anfield rap.
Amongst many things.
Yeah,
a classic of his own time, Bill Rapp. But we couldn't get that high, we knew. So we aimed lower than that. I think it was, you know, because it's tricky with England as well, and it's tricky, you know, with all, you know, there's certain associated things and there can be a bit of a dark side to it all. So we just really wanted to make sure that we didn't do the cliched things and that we made it, you know, something joyous that a foot. And I think, you know, I think really Frank and David really were instrumental in they really wanted it to be the feeling of, you know, being a football fan is disappointment an awful lot of the time. Do you know what I mean? It's not, it's not happiness, and and certainly being an England fan has been disappointments an awful lot of the time.
But that, I think it's half the fun. And I think when Chelsea turned into United and started winning everything all the time, I mean, Chelsea fans will hate me for saying this, but I became a little bit disappointed. I quite liked it in the Vialli era and all that sort of era where we might get a cup run. You know, we're never going to win the league. We might get a cup. Zola and all those guys. It was so exciting. And even before that, but then suddenly when you start winning and you think you're going to win every week, it's not as much fun, I don't think.
I always remember going to get, I don't know if I agree with you on that. You know, it's
being good, a Liverpool
it's good
fan.
When you, no, it's good when you win, and we haven't won it for a long time, the Premiership. But I do remember when I was a kid and used to go to the games, and it was like the 80s, you know, amazing teams. And people used to moan. I remember being at the ground and everyone used to moan. They used to say, they just kill everyone off in the first half and then they don't bother in the second half, you know. And it was like, that. I suppose that's a similar sort of thing. It felt like we'd won by half time. And then we just go through the motions for the second half, which is okay, really, isn't it? That you're actually moaning because you score all your goals early on.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, we're doing this off the back of Chelsea losing Spurs, which is the worst thing to happen to us. And I actually got really passionate watching the match, and it's hard for me to get really passionate about it now. And I'm watching going, oh God, what the hell are you doing? And afterwards, I thought I quite enjoyed that because I actually had some emotions in it watching us lose so badly to Spurs, expecting us to beat them, you know?
Well, I think that what you're talking about is exactly what I'm saying. But, you know, the conflicted life of a football fan where it's almost like, you know, it is slightly masochistic, isn't it?
It is,
like you're suffering for it, but it's exciting and you're alive and you're awake and you're in that moment. And I think That's the thing about being a footballer, is when you're in that moment, winning or losing, it's great, really.
And that's when you captured it in three lines. Was it in conjunction with the FA ever?
Yeah, well, originally it was in conjunction with the FA. And then I played, the tune to Frank, and then they did the lyric, really. We kind of had the idea of it's coming home. And then they wrote that fantastic lyric. And I guess, the FA basically didn't like it when we delivered it. They
really
didn't like it. And the guy from the FA, kind of got in touch and said, right, you need to get rid of those two and call it The Beautiful Game. Rewrite the lyric. That's my memory of it, really. Do you know
right,
what I mean?
Yeah.
This isn't going to fly. We don't like this. And what's it all about? I mean, when you think about it now, it's kind of everything's quite different after the fact. When you think about that, you're handing the FA something that starts off saying, we're rubbish.
Yeah.
We blow it every time. What's going on? I suppose that I get that they were a bit like,
of course,
this isn't what we were expecting.
Yeah.
So it was sort of, so then at one point it was a bit like, well, if you don't like it, I think at this point we like it and we'll do it, and it won't be with the FA. We'll just do it, And I think it was going to be that for a bit. And then it kind of went back to being the FA kind of came on board a little bit. And we had to go and play it to, the squad.
Yep.
So we went up to where they were all training. And in a way, that was the moment it did sort of dawn on me that it might be, because I think at first it was pretty weird, actually, a typical kind of FA thing of that time where they were all in the canteen having dinner and they'd just been training, they were all in the trackies. And we said, well, how are you going to play it to them? How are you presenting it? And they said, oh, we'll pipe it in through the Muzak system. I was like, that's not going to really give it full effect, So it was like, well, we haven't thought about that. And then Gaza said, I've got a ghetto blaster in my room. I'll go and get it,
Right.
So he went and got his ghetto blaster. And, when you think now, I don't think that would happen now.
No.
It was all a bit more, it could be the 70s, couldn't it?
Yeah.
So then he got his ghetto blaster and we played it. And I think there was a funny reaction because it was, I think at first, when you first hear it, does come across like it might be slightly negative, but obviously it isn't negative, and it was a record for the fan, not for the team, really. It wasn't, we're going to win the league, it wasn't that, and it was, and I think Frank was really good, and he kind of, it was a bit of a funny atmosphere, and then he got up and he sort of explained it and said, we're with you, and it's a hopeful song, and it's a lovely song, really, and then they kind of seemed to get it gradually. And I remember Terry Venable saying, I think it's great, and he really liked it. And then it came out to kind of mixed kind of reception as well. People didn't really get it at first, really, And then it just seemed to grow to the point where during the competition, to be fair, it was number one before the competition, and then it had gone down. I think they released it a bit early, probably. And then during the competition, everyone just seemed to adopt it more,
Well, World in Motion was before, wasn't it? And that had been a good song, hadn't it, for us?
Everyone says that.
You don't like it?
I love New Order.
Yeah.
That would not be my... I think that's very laddie. It sort of reminds me of the end of the Hacienda, where it's all coked up and kind of... Not the good bit, But it is. I shouldn't be saying that in public. And I do. I love New Order, and that was a moment, and I loved Italian.
It was a moment. And then we had Vindaloo, which was another huge one after you, but yours just keeps coming back. What is it about that song you think that captures us every time? During the last World Cup, it was in my head every day. As soon as I woke up till I went to bed, it was just going round and round and round.
I think it's unrequited until we win, isn't it? Something about that song is like, when we win.
What is it about the song, though?
Honestly,
songs.
I think that's it. I think it is. It's kind of about, when's it coming? When's it going to come? So it is, you know, if we win it, I don't know what would happen, really. But until then, it's kind of, it does, feels like, wait, it's me anyway. It's just like, that's the word I'd use, unrequited.
But it's got quite a few hooks in it, hasn't it? Quite a few different bits of it, which we all hook onto, I suppose.
I think it's, you know, it wasn't intentional, but it seems very adaptable. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like that you can have a brass band play it, and you can have, it seems like it's, it's.
I have a love-hate with it because I love it so much, but it makes me really emotional. I reckon it's one of the songs which it conjures up so many things of times gone by when I was with my mates, and it's the World Cup. And I think World Cup's an amazing time in this country. I don't know if it's the same in every country, but it's the time where you can go, actually, I don't have to do anything apart from watch football. You know,
it is the same because I think that's why it works, is that you see footage of every country.
Yeah.
And that's what's going on. But
you can go, look, I am at work, but I'm not really at work because I'm waiting for Thursday when England are playing.
And no one minds if you take an hour off.
Everyone's sort of enjoying themselves, and no one seems to care about doing anything. They just want to go to the pub and watch the football or go around someone's house. Beautiful times, yeah. Will it go again in 4 years' time, do you think? Do you think we'll have the song again in 4 years' time?
I think it's just about, it's about the team, really. I think if the team play well, and it's the first time it will have been here since Euro 96,
yeah.
So maybe because it's here, and if the team seem in a good place, so if they're playing here and they're in a good place and they play like we hope they might, then maybe.
Did you play any gigs whilst the World Cup was on?
Yeah, I don't really usually play Three Lions except when there's a competition on.
What was the atmosphere
like? Only when England are in it, really, because it just feels a bit silly otherwise, you know. So I don't get to play it that much.
And what happened when you play it?
Sorry,
what happens when you play it to the World Cup?
Yeah, very strongly, you know, very strongly, you know. And it's great. It is great when it's the right moment to play it. It's really good fun to play.
Are you still enjoying working in the industry?
Which industry?
Music industry. Are you still enjoying?
I feel like I'm not that. It's funny, the music, my sort of teenage reaction to that would be, I'm not in the music industry. I'm a songwriter, you know? And I still, a large part of me feels like that.
Right,
you know what I mean?
I see. Okay.
I feel like I've tried quite hard not to be too in that, but then I have produced a lot of records, right? You know, so it is fair to say that I probably have skirted around the edges of that in my own way. And it's strange, actually, because a few years ago, I think the world has changed so much for everyone in everything they do. I think, you know, the internet, technology, download, you know, it's changed everyone's life, changed the high street, changed everything.
Yes.
And music almost more than film. And, you know, more than anything, really, for musicians, it's changed everything. So there's a completely new blueprint to being a musician, and the whole, it's an amazing thing, really, you know. So it's, everything is upside down. It feels like 50% good and 50% bad to me, almost. It's like the idea originally, like I started playing music in the era of punk rock, really, you know, and the main sort of lightning bolt in my head was, you know, ideas, not music. People say, oh, in a punk rock, anyone could join a band and all that, which I don't think, they could, but it wouldn't be very good, you know what I mean? But I think what it focused everyone back on was an idea. And I remember being about 17 and it suddenly hitting me that, because, you know, everyone feels a bit like, well, I'm not going to be as good as those guys, you know, Jimmy Page or whoever it might be. They're fantastic, you know, and these people. And then it sort of occurs to you, and you think, you know what, if you've got a good idea and you do it, you're not that good at doing it, it's always going to be a good idea.
Yeah.
If you haven't got a good idea, no matter how well you do it, it's never going to be a good idea. So focus on the idea and find something to do, in the same way someone doing a painting. You know, you see interviews with Hockney or someone like that, and it's always about the preparation and the idea, or you know, it's not so much that no one could slice a cow.
Yeah.
It's just thinking of slicing a cow or whatever, you know what I mean? And I think music, well, for me, it's always been a bit like that. It's always been, you know, the lead up to the recording, or the having the idea. I think it was the same with Three Lions. It was, you know, and obviously I'm a Liverpool fan, but You'll Never Walk Alone was a big emotional tug on my heart when I was a kid, you know, yeah. Seeing my dad sing it, seeing the Cop. It was the 60s, the Cop would be singing Beatles songs and You'll Never Walk Alone, grown men singing Floodlights, The Grass. Massive thing for me, do you know what I mean? So, you know, I wanted Three Lions to be what you said before, it makes you quite emotional. Mm. That was something I really, really... You know, I like the idea of an emotional football song. I don't really like, you know.
Is the Beatles, were the Beatles and Liverpool Football Club in a way sort of bad for Liverpool? Because what comes after it, it's hard to live up, isn't it, to Lennon, McCartney, Kenny Dalglish. I mean, it's tough, isn't it, for everybody who comes in their wake?
Yeah, I think you could probably say that about, I mean, maybe, but look at United at that era. You know, George Best, Bobby yeah. Charlton. You know, I sort of think it's a great thing to have to live up to, really. Okay. It's great.
You know? Well, you told me once that you came down to London when you were a punk. You came down here, didn't you, to...
Sure, many times, yeah.
For a while. Did you get in any of the London...
Oh, to live in London.
Yeah, yeah. In the London bands. Did yeah. you end up coming... Did you end up in any of the bands down here? What was that process like?
Yeah, it was kind of difficult, actually. There was my mate Budgie, who was a drummer... And we were in this band big in Japan, and then we decided, you know, to stop the band. And we kind of went, you could get a return, cheap return, I think it was called, budget return for 12 quid. You could get to London, you know. So we thought, you know, let's go to London. You know, that would be really good. So, and we didn't give it an awful lot of thought. So we just packed a little bag and got to Euston and spent a lot of time around Euston
with a guitar.
It was quite a sunny day. Not even with a guitar, to be fair. You know, we sort of, right, we're here, you know, what should we do and all this? And then we saw a poster for a gig, and it was The Clash at the Music Machine, which was nearby. But obviously you didn't have your phone then to find out.
Yeah.
So we wandered round through Camden. We finally got to the, and I think it was just like, well, I don't know why we headed for that. You know, it was just like, well, that's something we know. And a week before, that tour had been at Eric's in Liverpool, which was a club. And I used to load the equipment to help, you know, be one of the humpers that helped yeah. the band. So I'd like hung out a bit with the support band. And we got there, and it was like a very sunny day, and they were sort of outside. And I think Mick Jones was outside. We said, you know, can we come in, kind of thing? And he was, yeah, come in. You know, I think Mick Jones kind of got us in. And funnily enough, the band were the Coventry Automatics, who then changed their name to the Coventry Specials and the Specials. Mm. You know what I mean? So I think that's funny, because that was my first meet with Terry, who's one of my best friends.
Who you end up working with, yeah.
So it was quite, it was kind of a momentous day. And Budgie was this great drummer, you know, and within... You know, a moment he was playing with the Slits and then Susie and the Banshees, and I was kind of living in a squat in Kilburn. I went home. So I went back to Liverpool not long after, and I was in a band for a little while, but it always it felt like perhaps London wasn't quite ready for me.
that band though, Big in Japan, I don't really know a lot about your band.
Not a lot to know, to be fair, you know.
Well, apart from Holly Johnson was in it.
Yeah.
Frankie Goes to Hollywood. You mentioned Budgie there, yourself. Someone else was in it. I can't remember. I was just looking up the other day. Who else was in it? Who ended up? Bill Drummond. That was it. KLF. Yeah. I mean, what a band.
Yeah. Just before we were all good.
But that's an amazing...
It's a funny old lineup when you think about it. Yeah. It's... I suppose what's strange about that in a funny way is people are in bands and they can be, you know, they can do really well and they can have a few hits, and then 5 years later, that's that bit of their life over.
Yeah.
And they do something else, and that's quite positive. I suppose they burn brightly in a way. And then some people, you just get the feeling they're just going to be that forever, and they might do other things like Bill writes books or, but essentially Budgie's a drummer.
Right.
I'm a guitar player who writes songs, you know, Holly's there doing his albums. And Bill's still doing KLF weird things somewhere or other in the world, I'm sure, you know what I mean? So it's quite, I think we were just all, that was who we were. We were a bunch of kind of misfits, really, do you know what I mean? And I think
Eric's was a place where a lot of people went to that club, but we were sort of, you know, we'd be there all day kind of thing, sitting outside, whether it be McCulloch from the Bunny, you know, we were all there or in the record shop, and it was kind of our life all the time. And I think we were all, as I said, I think Misfits, who kind of were connected by liking Bowie and the Velvet Underground and maybe Mark Bolan. So we had that in common, and maybe meeting other people who knew about that and liked that, we had an instant kind of connection that's almost like a family connection. And a lot of those people, I, you know, don't see them that often, but they feel like close, you know.
But when Big in Japan, how you obviously had some singles out and stuff like that. Were you close to making it big time at all?
No. I mean, to be fair, it's hard to remember. I don't think it was even going for more than a few months. Do you know what I mean? It's kind of lived really? Long in the memory. But it's not like, I mean, you probably only did about 20 gigs or something. And in Liverpool at that time, you know, everyone was forming bands and doing this and doing that. And, you know, we did a few gigs and it was really good fun. And we, you know, but it was, I don't think it was ever, you know, destined for, it's not like I think, oh, if we'd have got the breaks, do you know what I mean? It's nothing like that, you know. It's just, it was a great moment for me encountering those people who were, I think probably I was coming from, although I was only about 17 or so, I was coming from music, you know, being quite obsessed with music, and they were coming from more of a visual, maybe arty kind of thing. And it was like a revelation to me. It was like, I love this and I love and then also realizing, yeah, of course, that's why I love the Velvets and that's why I love, but you know, because it is a mixture of all these things.
Yeah.
But the penny hadn't dropped. And although I don't think you'd typically say that what I've done is like that, I think on some level, you know, the record, the Lightning Seeds record, they don't sound like what was going on around them at the time, I don't think. And I think that's probably why, really. It's, they're not really a group in a room, which, you know, a lot of things from Liverpool, in a good way, you know, are a group in a room.
So there was a conscious decision to move away from punk and towards Lightning Seeds.
I think I'd been producing and I'd been working with The Fall, and I'd been working with the Bunnymen and all that, and it felt like they do all that.
Had you been producing before Lightning Seeds, though?
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, Lightning Seeds. I did everything kind of the wrong way around, you know. I came to London the wrong way, went home. It was, I think, the first band that I ever... And I never really wanted to be a producer. And the first band that I ever produced was Echo and the Bunnymen.
Ian McCulloch.
And they were my mates from being in, you know, in town and in Eric's. And I was at a bus stop on a place called Smithdown Road in Liverpool. And it was raining. And they had a van. Les had bought a van. And they'd signed a record deal, you know, which was quite a thing in those days. And I was at this bus stop getting soaked, and they drove past and stopped and said, do you want a lift, you know? So I got in the van, I was going along, and they had this cassette on in the van. Sounds like, a, you know, an ancient story in black and white, doesn't it, with a cassette and all that. And they said, you know, and I said, oh, this is good, what's this, you know? And they were like, it's us, you know, we've signed a deal, we've just been to Wales, this place, Rockfields, great studio, but it hasn't worked out very well. And me being me, I went, oh, that's because this needs to be faster, that bit should be the core, you know, you want to change that around and this, that and the other. And I'd always been that, you know, when they were starting, I remember them saying, what type of drum machine should we get? And I was always that fella who people would ask that stuff. I don't know why particularly, you know. And then I got a call a couple of days later, and Bill Drummond was the manager. And I got a call saying, you know, Mac and Will was saying, you know, like that you had a load of ideas, you know, do you fancy producing a record? And I was like, no, I don't want to be a producer. That's like stepping over a line. I'm a musician. Mm. What's a producer? It's like, you know, the only ones I like are, you know, Phil Spector and George Martin. They're kind of businessy, aren't they? And they were like, oh, we think you'd be really good. So then they phoned back and the record company phoned. And then Bill said, and we'd, as a game, we all used to have our alternative names that, you know, our cartoon names. And then, so he said, you know, what about if you produce it under the name Kingbird and we don't put your name on it? So I said, well, as long as you don't put my name on it, I'll produce it. So it doesn't have my name on the track. That's a Kingbird production, you know. So it was a funny way that I stepped into being a producer, but then all of a sudden I was a producer, you know. And it was actually, funny enough, you know, you hear people talking about Mark E. Smith an awful lot. And,
yeah.
You know, what a...
Well, especially recently, he died, didn't
yeah,
he?
And, yeah. And, you know, how, you know, it's a lot of it's quite negative and yeah. stuff, you know. And he was fantastic with me. And I'd just written a couple of songs and I really wanted to do my group, but I'd been producing for a few years. And he was so encouraging. And he used to send me, he didn't want me to call it the Lightning Seeds, to be fair. He wanted me to call it the Hordes of Brood. And he really wanted me to call it the Hordes of Brood. And I was like, I'm not calling it the Hordes of Brood. You know, it was like, he had kind of an idea of what the Hordes would look like. But he was really, really very encouraging. And it kind of gave me a lot of confidence to, not that much confidence, but enough confidence to actually put a record out and write Pure, and kind of, that changed me back into being a songwriter again from being a producer, you know.
What does a producer actually do?
Whatever he need to do. And that is the strange thing. It's, you know, all groups are different. All sort of genres of music are kind of different. And it's the producer's job to allow the artist to make a great record. I saw a quote. Eno's always talking about very laterally, but I did see a great quote once from him where he said, they were asking him, he had Daniel Lanois, who's a great engineer, producing U2. He was producing U2 and they were working a lot with this guy. And they said, well, what do you do? You know, as the producer, what's your job? If he's getting all the sounds, great. And he said, usually I make the tea. But know in the right moment when everyone needs a cup of tea can be the most important thing on the record. And I think that is true. So it's almost like whatever is going to make the creative thing flow and people feel comfortable. So it might be with a certain band, you know, that you need to, you know, be disciplined. You've got to get in here. Another band, you might just need the lights low and to do it late at night and get a fabulous feeling. You know, everything's really, if you're Phil Spector, you kind of just point guns at everyone and make them sing it right. You know, everyone's got their own method, you know.
But Marky Smith and, I mean, Ian McCulloch's a strong personality. Marky Smith, all the great front men are, aren't they? That must be quite a tough gig when you're producing that lot.
Well, I think those two, you know, I don't know, yeah. I suppose to a degree that the odd thing is that I did the Lightning Season, because I think I probably am someone who would be next to the guy who's the main guy in the band, really, if that guy had come along, possibly. But I have to say, Ian McCulloch as well, he was the one who always, you know, you should produce us, come and do this. When I hadn't really had any experience, and he was always... So in some ways, you know, he was, because I think it's quite a big deal if you're in a group and it's your opportunity and you've signed a record deal and your future is resting on it, to sort of let one of your mates make all the decisions and, you know, get it sounding a certain way. It's quite a leap of faith, isn't it? You know what I mean? So he showed fantastic faith in me, really, and was probably instrumental in me being able to do that, really. He was always supportive of that, you know.
The Lightning Seeds is you, though, isn't it? And did you end up producing yourself? Was it just basically everything, 100% down to you?
Different times. So when I started Lightning Seeds, it was around that time I was producing The Fall, and, you know, there were lots of bands. So basically there was... The major labels were in Liverpool a fair bit, and they were giving really big record deals to, like, I don't know, Shaq or The Lars, The Real People, Rain, all these bands. They all had big record deals with the major labels. And of course, I didn't play live, didn't have a band, just kind of a bit of a boffin in the studio, really. So I didn't, there was no real route for me to do anything. And, there was a guy, a publisher who I knew, who was quite a 60s type of character, big cigar and all that. And he heard a demo of mine and he phoned me up and he said, you know, this is lovely. You know, what are you doing and all that? And it was like, well, I don't know what I'm doing. I don't have a band and I don't. And in those days, now you kind of got a computer, it doesn't really matter. But then that didn't exist, you know. So anyway, he said, you know, let's record some stuff and put it out. And I was like, well, what about a label? And he said, we'll just have a few printed up. We'll do it like an indie label, which is what Big in Japan had been. So that was the idea. So I recorded Pure and basically recorded it at home, mostly in, you know, just in the house I had a sampler and, you know, and then I went, got downtime in a studio overnight and mixed it. And my friend Chenzo, who was engineering a lot of my productions with me, he mixed it with me and stuff like that. So initially it just came out of that, and then Pure, they pressed up a few copies and it was around for months and months. It just gradually kept getting more and more momentum and all this. So it was kind of a bit of a one-man band at that point, you know. And then later on, you know, so it was, I was on an indie label. There was no, you know, no real support really, or, you know, advance or anything like that. And it just kind of rolled on. And then later on, I think they went bankrupt. A Rough Trade went bankrupt. And I ended up signing to Sony. And that was the point where, you know, they kind of prized me out of the studio and said, you know, it's your third album. You should do a gig. And I was like, oh, I don't sing in public, you know. So in the end, it was quite hard really, because the first gigs I was doing, you know, were to, you know, 1,000 people. And I'd never sung in public before, so I was pretty rubbish at it for quite a while. It took a while to get going. And then it wasn't a one-man band operation. Then it became other people. And really, in terms of the records, Jollification and Dizzy Heights and stuff like that, there was a guy called Simon Rogers who was in The Fall, and I met him through that. And we worked together a lot on my records. And Chenzo Townsend, who had always got great sounds for me. And the three of us really used to be just ensconced in a room, and we'd make the records, the three of us really.
When you wrote Pure, was there a moment where you thought, I think I've got something here?
No, quite the reverse, actually. Yeah.
Really?
The story of that, I seem to be telling a lot of stories.
It's good.
So I wrote that, and then we went to do the recording, and we were mixing what was essentially the first album. And we were mixing that track, and that was the first song that I really wrote on my own and sung on my own. And we were mixing it, and I thought, this is rubbish. I've done this wrong. There's way too many words that you don't get this many words in a song. It's ridiculous. It's like,
I was just saying that to Mark before you came, actually. The thing about Pure is there's a lot of lyrics in
there. So many words. So I tried to cut some out of it, and I did. And, really? You know, yeah, I did.
Wow.
And then we were mixing it, and we'd been mixing it for a few hours, and I said to Chenzo, listen, this just hasn't worked, this tune. Just take it. I'm not going to put this on. This is rubbish, you know. And so we never finished mixing it. And he said, I'll just put it onto the DAT machine. And I was like, no, just don't bother. But he did. And it was on the DAT that went off to this publisher guy.
Right.
And he came back and said, that's the song. And I was like, no, that's not on the album. And there was a bit of a row, you know. And thank goodness he was right, really, you know. And then once it was out of context and I just heard it, I got it straight away, you know. I thought, oh no, that he's right, yeah, you know. But at the time, it just felt like, but I think that's because it was, I think part of being in a band and just making music is you've got to be prepared to make a fool of yourself. You've got to be prepared to be a bit vulnerable, let a bit of yourself out that maybe you would want to guard. And I think that was the thing with Pure. It felt a bit like I was telling everyone something right. that I wanted to keep to myself. And I was very uncomfortable with that for ages. And I didn't really like it being on the radio. And it took a while for me to get used to that. You know?
I can ask my stupid question now. I was looking at your sort of body of work yesterday. I was going through it all and I was thinking, oh God, there's hit after hit after hit. How do you write a hit?
No idea. Yeah, no. I mean, that's the thing, isn't it? I think there's people who, you know, Burt Bacharach or people who are able to do that. But I think, you know, and obviously that's a question that goes around my head a lot, you know, how do you write a hit, or what, do you want to write a hit? Do you want to write a song? Do I think Bob Dylan sits there and wants to write a hit, or does he want to write a great song? I think he just wants to write a great song. And I think in the end, you just have to try and write a great song. And I think some songs, when you record them, there's a magic that happens and they become hit records.
Right.
Yeah, I think, you know, that's, and obviously that's not true of everything. It's a sweeping generalization, you know. But I sort of think, you know, it's like when you hear a Beatles record, pretty much every track on every Beatles record could be a hit, couldn't it? Because it's just something magical in it.
Yeah, but isn't that because we know them so well as well?
Probably, you know, but it just does feel like that. It feels like you could isolate any of them, play them to someone who's never heard them, and they, you know, they'd probably, you know, well, different generations do seem to get it. And I don't think that's, you know, much as I think they were brilliant, them fellas, I think it's more about a certain magic of the times and the situation and something going into the tape and that moment, you know, a bit like what you were saying about a memory of the World Cup, or, you know, I think it's the same sort of thing, just something that is a little bit above logic and science, or something goes into something and it becomes an amazing thing.
There's this program on Netflix, it's called Beatbugs, and what they did is, it's a cartoon, and we've got a young daughter, she's 5 now, but we've been watching Beatbugs since she was about 3. And what they've done is they set every single cartoon episode of this cartoon, they're bugs basically, to a Beatles song. And then they get people in like Pink or whoever, and they sing them. Wow. And so she constantly says to me, "Will you put the Bugs music on, which is the Beatles?"
Wow.
And and I just think it's amazing. She walks around singing Beatles songs all around the house all the time. Yeah. And I think, and she adores it. She absolutely loves it. She loves the Beatles. And now she loves ABBA because of Mamma Mia. And then I've got twins as well, as you know, they're 16-year-olds. And we're going back to the music industry, how much it's changed. What I find phenomenal about them is they sit there, they've got Spotify accounts, and they listen to music. The body of work they can listen from, the body of music they can listen from. So they'll be sitting there, and there'll be ELO, there'll be ABBA, and then there'll be the Specials, and then there'll be the Beatles, and there'll be something, Rihanna or something, then Snoop Dogg, and then suddenly a Disney tune. They've got so much to choose from, and I think that is the major point which has changed in the music industry, is if I wanted to spend some money on a record when I was a kid, I'd buy something new.
Yeah, you're up against the whole of history, really, aren't you?
Yeah, you're not going to go and buy the Beatles or the Doors or something. You're going to buy something, I'll buy the Specials, you know, or the Beat or whoever. I'd go for something new and what's happening now. Nowadays, everybody can go retrospective. So there's this massive body of work that people, and they also spend a lot, sorry, I'm ranting here, but there's also a lot of time, they spend a lot of time watching the movies and also American sitcoms and those sort of shows. And as soon as they put a track in, so if they use a Lightning Seeds track and stick it in whatever they're watching at the moment, they'll go and download it.
Yeah, yeah. No, absolutely. It's a different way that it's the, I mean, I used to find, I think you're exactly right on that. And another aspect of it is that, like, my dad loved Sinatra.
Yeah.
And growing up, there was a couple of music shows on, so I would maybe see Sinatra one time in 3 years, because he was a guest on Parkinson or something, and he'd do a song, and it was an old bloke, and I couldn't relate to it at all. Whereas now I can go on YouTube and I see a guy in a zoot suit with a load of energy and girls screaming, and he's Sinatra.
Yeah.
And I think it was like that for my son Riley. So he'd look at the Smiths, and he would see the Smiths in their prime, or the Doors in their prime, looking amazing, playing a gig. Timeless, you know, so you're much more likely to like, you know, the Smiths if you're seeing them in their prime on YouTube than you are, you know, Morrissey doing a gig now or something, you know. Not there's anything wrong with Morrissey doing a gig now, but so you are, in fact, you know, it's almost like things that were moments culturally that if you weren't there, you missed it.
Yeah.
Now, you know, you're almost, you know, everyone's experiencing our youth, the father's youth, you know, the grandfather's youth. You can kind of key into it all and get it and understand what it was.
I went to see The Who, Royal Albert Hall. I was hosting the Teenage Cancer Trust gigs, which I do for them. And The Who played with, and they had a big screen behind them. And through the whole of the big screen, they did images of the mods and the past and what they looked like years ago, all through the 60s and 70s and everything, all through their eras. So you were buying into the old Who whilst the new Who, current Who were on stage. It was a brilliant experience because you had all the visuals from when they're playing.
You've got a reference.
Yeah, My Generation, and you've got the reference. It's fantastic. It was such a great gig.
Which you couldn't have before. You know, it would be a lost, that time would be lost.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Or, you know, because there was no, you know, that footage obviously existed because it's on YouTube now, but we'd never have access to it or get to see it.
Mm.
So we'd have to find. And, you know, in some ways that's a negative and some ways that's a positive because, like you said, you know, I would have to find. So for me, finding television group from New York and Patti Smith and you know, Talking Heads and loving that and going to New York, you know, trying to find those groups and the Ramones, you know, it was a mission. And it would be something special to you and your friends that the world couldn't share, you know, and your parents didn't know about. And there was a certain element of that. And I think that feeds into youth culture in a way that music doesn't anymore.
Tough gig though now, if you're a young band, you're coming through and you're putting your music out, but you're up against, because the world is streaming now, as we know, but you're up against the Beatles and the Smiths and you're trying to put new music out there. It's a tough gig now because of that, isn't it?
It's a tough gig for that, and also because whereas before, you know, someone play great gigs in a little club and the word would go around, this band are great. Mm. But the reality of that, if it's filmed on someone's phone and on YouTube and you look at it, you think, well, it's not that great. Whereas before, it would just be said it was great and it would be like kind of legendary. And by the time you saw it, they had time to become great.
Yeah.
Whereas really there's just an inkling of them being great, but they're exposed before they can become that, you know.
Don't you? You're right. Yeah. And it's a modern thing as well. It's pretty. I went to see the Strokes. They came over, played at Heaven, and I was working on XFM at the time. So I had tickets to go and see it. And outside there was people offering me hundreds of pounds, like £400, because the Strokes, their image and their name had come from New York. And I know that's pretty modern history, but still it wasn't as modern as we're talking about now with the social media and everything.
Yeah.
And
well, that was just before. I think just, the Strokes was the last wave, wasn't it, before people were at gigs with their phones.
Yeah.
I remember that first happening, you were playing a gig and there were loads of phones there and you were like, wow, this is weird, you know.
What was that like?
when I started playing gigs, you'd be in Bradford on a winter's night or something in the 70s and it was punk rock and people spat at you if they liked you. And that was horrible. I hated that. So phones are no problem for me, you know.
I wonder why the spitting stuff started.
It was horrible.
I was talking to Tony James about this because of Generation X and, what's his name? Spiky blonde hair.
Billy Idol.
And he remembers Billy getting all spat on and one gig at the 100 Club or something. And then we're going, what the hell is that going on here? And he said he was all right. He could move to the back of the stage with his guitar. But Billy was out the
singer.
Front.
I'm glad I wasn't the singer, I tell you.
getting spat on. I mean,
well, your clothes would be covered in phlegm.
Just,
you know,
disgusting. Really,
the most revolting bit of my entire career was that moment, you know.
Oh God. Let's go back to writing music. How do you write? What comes first? The lyrics, the melody? What's the most important bit, do you think?
Well, I try to not write so much on instruments. I just talk into my phone with an idea of how I think it could be, and I have a tune. So my stuff's always led by the melody. It's all done a bit backwards. So I always have a melody and a ridiculously basic little thing where I might then pick up a guitar into the phone and record it, and then I'll just, if it survives 3 years and I can go back to it and it still sounds like, oh, there's something in that, I think, oh, there is something in that, because sometimes when you're doing it yourself you don't know the good from the bad.
Yeah.
But I think if they survive this horrible process of being almost just like, you know, made to sound the worst they could be. And then it's quite a difficult, I find it really difficult then, because I get it on the phone and I'll send it over to the computer and there'll be something in that I can never get. But if I played it to someone, they'd just say, that's just a horrible phone with you humming out a tune. But for me, there's something quite special in it. And it's quite hard then not to ruin it with loads of stuff.
Right.
So I think I tend to put stuff on and then subtract and subtract and subtract to try and I think I'm doing it really well, and then I realise that I've lost it, and then I have to take things away to get back to what it originally was. So it's a really weird, I'm not one of them, I'm not like, you know, you read about Elvis Costello, five songs a day, and he just reads them off and does the lyric. I can't do that at all, you know. But then in a weird way, afterwards, after it's gone through this ridiculously convoluted process, I can sit there on an acoustic and play it all through.
Right.
And it is, sounds like it was just done in a moment on an acoustic.
I had BB Rexha on my on Sunday brunch this weekend, and she wrote The Monster, Eminem with Rihanna, and she's written loads of hit singles for herself and for everybody else. And first album out at the moment, and she was saying she had so much anxiety, and I was like, why? She goes, well, if people don't like it, well, if it's no good. And I thought, what? Because you don't think about that. But as a songwriter, as soon as you put a tune out there, there's got to be a bit of anxiety in that. What are people going to make of my lyric? What are people going to make of the tune? Is there?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think that's what I was touching on earlier when I was saying, if you're going to be in a group, it's all about being prepared to fall, being prepared to make a fool of yourself, being prepared for people to throw things at you, and it will happen, and it has happened to me, that's for sure, you know, and that's the thing, you have to be willing to make a fool of yourself. But I think even if you're an actor or a presenter, I think that's the same thing, you have to be prepared to be a fool and then get good at it, and you know, so I think it is, and not only that, I think where it's different for musicians, fighting the musician's corner here, what I find quite fascinating is that if you do a record, not only has everyone got license to criticize your lyric that you were saying, and but they can criticize your haircut, they can criticize your accent, everything about
the way you're performing,
the way you walk, you know, they can just say anything that if you walked in a room and someone said it to you, you know, you'd punch them, you know. But it's kind of, if you're a musician, that's okay, you can just say anything, really. So you have to really be prepared to I said to someone the other day, Twitter now has made everyone experience what we had to experience anyway.
Yes.
So if you do something on Twitter and everyone's at you, as a musician, that's what you had to do anyway. But at least on Twitter, you can reply. Whereas we could never reply. You know, if someone said something, you know, you could never had any right of reply. So I quite like, you know, the idea that now at least you can get on there and say, that's wrong, you know.
Yeah, well, so I suppose that's a big decision, isn't it? When you decide you're going to go on stage live and perform, and you're the front man, you're going to sing pure and do whatever, you're going to think, what am I going to dance? What am I going to wear? What am I going to... Those are the decision process, aren't they? Fortunately, you're behind a guitar, so you're all right, but...
Well, no, because I think with Lightning Seeds was the first time I had to sing. And I always remember, it was great, actually, because I remember I was chatting with Terry, and I was like, I've got to do gigs and all that. And
Terry Hall, my hero, said, in the specials.
Yeah. I'll tell you what, it might be easier. Why don't we do gigs together? And we'll, you know, so we did my first ever gigs. We used the same band because I was producing him at the time. We were using the same musicians. And I'd do like four or five songs. Then he'd come on and we'd do two or three together that we'd written. And then I'd go off and he'd carry on and do his gig at the
end.
And it was, so that was my first couple of gigs. But the only thing that went wrong was, I remember on the first gig saying to whoever, I can't remember who it was, but and I was saying, I'm terrified, I don't think I can go on. I just had the idea of looking at those people while I'm trying to sing. And they said to me, shut your eyes, you know, and, you know, just go up there and shut your eyes and it'll just, you get lost in the music, it'll be fine. And I remember I shut my eyes at the wrong time and I went to sing and the mic was closed. I just smashed my nose into the microphone, you know, and everyone laughed. And I thought, well, it doesn't get any worse than that, really. And I was okay.
Let it go better. How did you become mates with Terry then?
I guess through, I suppose I first met him there when he was doing those gigs and help and loading the equipment in. And then we played football actually in a place called Sefton Park in Liverpool, because I think he was living in Manchester at one point. And Pete from the Bunnymen was drumming in the Colour Field. And so I think, you know, we were playing football, and then while we were playing football, we ended up, I produced a couple of tracks and we became mates. And then when I was doing my stuff, we started writing a bit together. And that was that, really, you know.
I love Terry Hall. I've had this conversation with you once before. I do worry at the moment, and I'm probably just being an old man here, but I worry that when you got people like Terry Hall, I think he was such an influential front man on so many people. I think people forget that he came along with this sort of miserable look, and you know, and it's sort of great vocal, amazing, like, you know, it's a Terry Hall vocal when it's a Terry Hall vocal. You got, you know, you got Bowie, you've got Jagger, you've got Ian McCulloch, all these great different vocals. It seems we're all going to perfect pitch singing now, like everyone's gone to singing school, and I worry about that because the great songs in my mind don't have that on.
Yeah, I mean, you're not wrong. Yeah, is I it, mean I think I think it goes back to if you've got an idea.
Yeah, you're
back
right.
To that original thing. If you've got an idea, you know, who cares if you're in tune, really? Do you know what I mean? I've always thought that. I always thought, I found it quite hard.
That's what you must have thought when you did Three Lions and Skinner and Badil turned up. Actually, Frank's all right, but David Badil admits he's not the greatest singer in the world, is he? Is
it? Yeah, no, I mean, but he did a great
he
job.
He did, yeah.
He did a great job.
Yeah, because the voices are now iconic because we know them so well.
And he, you know, he's a comedian, not a singer. So
yeah,
who
exactly.
You compared to Benny Hill, you know?
yeah. Yeah, so do you think that, I mean, yeah, you're right, it's an idea. I worry about that. And just going back a stage as well, we were talking about, you know, when you've got to actually put your ideas out there. I watched that film recently, Bohemian Rhapsody. And so it's about Queen, obviously, it's about Freddie. And you start thinking, that was quite an amazing thing that band did, where they went, hey, we're going to do like a operatic song. And then go, they capture it quite well in the film, where everyone's going, that's crap, you're not doing that. It's quite an idea, and also what Freddie's wearing on stage and the way he does. He's quite an amazing man, isn't he, Freddie Mercury, really?
Yeah, and I think when you look at most people, most of those great, iconic people, it's mostly is that sort of story. You know, Marvin Gaye, they wouldn't put What's Going On out for 2 years, would they? Because it didn't sound like a Motown record, and it was, what is this?
Really?
It's a lot about, oh, yeah, and Berry Gordy wouldn't put it out, didn't get it, you know, Get Back to doing Heard It Through the Grapevine, you know.
Oh, right, I didn't know that.
This, you know, and I think when you look at most people's careers, there's a lot of that where what they've done is regarded as a really bad idea, you know, but that idea becomes something else. The difficulty is now, I think, you know, that everyone, the media or probably the record company, everyone researches it, and it's all done. So
oh,
they look
gotcha.
At how many people are on Facebook, how many, you know, whereas really, you know, it's the one that came from nowhere.
Yeah.
That, you know, and almost all the really, it's very strange. I think what's happened is there used to be, like you said, the music industry. And I think there was the music industry.
Mm.
And when the Beatles came along, it became a certain thing. And that spread into the West Coast and the Doors and bands, even right leading mm-hmm. up to, the Strokes, you know, and then all of a sudden show business, which had always been kind of alongside, suddenly probably with X Factor zoomed up again and it swamped everything. And I think now no one's sure what music business and and show business, to separate it out is a bit harder. And all that stuff about people being, you know, going to music school and singing 50 notes at the same time, and you know, and it being on reality TV and being linked to, you know, to that stuff, it's really show business, I think. You know what I mean? And but there's no youth culture to no mods and not to drag it out, really. You know what I mean? So it's all just become one thing, but it's still pretty good, and there's great music out there. It's just there's no gatekeeper and there's no signposts.
Though I suppose in a way, My 16-year-old daughter, one of them the other day, was busy singing Wuthering Heights by Kate Bush, and she's started looking back at Kate Bush. Whoever signed Kate Bush, it's just, that was a masterstroke, wasn't it?
Because again, a really unlike, you know, Bush girl from wherever, and it's just that Dave Gilmour, wasn't it, recommended her and sat and worked with her on her songs. But it's the sort of thing where, in a way, that's same as the Queen thing. It's quite special because it's just like,
yeah,
you know, it's some quite posh girl from the country singing about Wuthering Heights. You know, it's like at the time when the Sex Pistols are out, you know, it's probably not the most obvious thing, you know.
But I suppose they're getting exposure to it, so it's bound to all come around again, isn't it? Yeah. Where people are looking, yeah, they're going to start looking for the modern version of that sort of things. And yeah, it's an interesting time. I mean, did you also work with Factory Records, I read, and you had a bit of time with Tony Wilson, did you?
If you read it, it is true.
Did that happen? Were you?
Yeah, no, yeah. Of course. Yeah.
What was it like that scene then? Were you big into, you mentioned the Hacienda earlier, were you around that whole thing?
Well, yeah, I mean, Liverpool, Manchester, contrary to the, you know, to what people, you know, they're very close to each other, and at that time, you know, there weren't many of us into that kind of, you know, that alternative bands and music and stuff like that. So we were quite close, really. You know, we were. When I say we were quite close, I don't mean it like we were bosom buddies. I mean more Manchester and Liverpool, that whole scene. So we'd do, you know, big in Japan. Tony Wilson, before he had the Hacienda, he had another. They opened a sort of gig in the middle of, I think it was Hume Industrial, Hume kind of big blocks of flats all around it. I forgot what you call it. Council Estates. So thank you. Now that I'm in London, I've forgotten all that, you know. and I forgot what it was called now. And we played the opening night big in Japan with a band called Manicured Noise. And, you know, all those guys would be around. And then Roger had come from doing the Twisted Wheel in Manchester in the 60s, where it was a mod club, and then Northern Soul Club, really. Yeah. And then he'd come to Liverpool and done Eric's. And then he went out and did a club called The International, which is where I first met the Stone Roses when they were all around there. And, you know, so the two scenes in those days, you know, and before Joy Division, they were called Warsaw. You know, we'd play on the same thing. So that whole thing was quite close. That's nothing to do with your question. Yeah, so, I mean, so we were very aware of each other. And I think I ended up producing a couple of bands for Factory, yeah. But and early on, the Hacienda was originally, before it was the Hacienda, it was a gig, and they'd opened it up, and they had the cocktail bar downstairs, you know, and you'd go over, and you'd always be hanging out with, you know, with the, you know, maybe Tony would be there, and you all, you know, and you'd be drinking. And I'd go over with maybe Mac and Will from the Bunnymen, and, you know, we'd all be hanging out. And the gig, the Bunnymen played there. Loads of people played there, and it was this big, echoey, terrible place. For so it was really not a good place to play a gig, really. But it had a real vibe to it, you know? And then that just kind of came around. And there was always the Hacienda, and there was another club under the Arches, the Boardwalk, I think it was called, or something. And originally I remember seeing Mike Pickering was the DJ there, and then he was the DJ in the Hacienda. And it just, it was very kind of natural the way it all came together and then became Manchester. And it was brilliant for a short period of time, I thought, you know what I mean? And it was great because actually when Pure came out, I always remember, even though that was dance music and real thing, everyone always used to say to me, oh, was it Hacienda? They played Pure, you know, they'd always play Pure. So it was a lovely thing, really.
I love Mike Pickering. I've got to get him on here. His stories are unbelievable.
Yeah.
So he's seen a lot, hasn't he? Yeah, he has seen a lot. And when you see each other now, you people from the that sort of scene, Liverpool, Manchester scene, is there a sort of like a, do you feel like you all did it, part of it? Are you all sort of,
yeah, I kind sort of like a knowing look? Yeah. Joy Division, it was all, you know, the Smiths, it did feel like the Northwest, really.
Yeah.
It never felt particularly, you know, there was no, you know, there's probably a bit of competition in the sense that you are with anyone, like, really, you want to do okay. But no, I think, and Tony had a bit of a down, he didn't really like Scousers that much, you know.
Really?
He didn't like Scousers, no. But I always got on, you know, because I met him because he was friend of mine, Nathan, who managed the Happy Mondays, but he was one of my mates from my sister's mates from school, actually. And So I was used to see Tony Wilson at his house because he'd worked at the Liverpool Echo before he was on Granada Report. So he was actually in Liverpool quite a lot, and I think I knew him before
but,
all that.
But us down here in London, there was a weird thing going on up there, because you look at it and there was like Tony Wilson sort of came down a bit. We sort of heard about him because he ended up on a TV show doing like a quiz game, and he called himself Anthony H. Wilson or something. Yeah. And then we saw Frank Sidebottom a bit because he was on, I think James Wales used to stick him on his nighttime show and stuff like that. But up in the Northwest, they were huge, weren't they? I mean, he was, Tony Wilson was the local reporter, and he had the nightclub and then the record label. Frank Sidebottom was huge up there, wasn't he?
Frank Sidebottom used to come to our gigs and do a little turn and introduce us early on.
Did he? Yeah. Oh, that's amazing. Because we had John Ronson on here not so long ago. And so John was talking all about his days with Frank Sidebottom and stuff. Yeah. So we were sort of slightly away from it all down in London, but you probably weren't aware of that. You probably thought it was nationwide what was going on. But we were just getting, there was another guy who used to walk around going donkey or something. And there was like all this stuff going on up there, which we were, it was filtering down slowly.
Yeah, no, I think there was... Well, I think the fact that Granada, you know, it's a lot smaller than London. So Tony was able to have the Sex Pistols on and have these shows on. You know, I think Big in Japan actually played that show. Was it So It Goes or Granada Report or something?
Right, okay.
I remember him introducing us vaguely. So I think that might have been my first TV, was he had us on. And he could do that, you know. He was like, it wasn't that big a deal. It's just local TV and you could just put these bands on. And he, you know, he just really... He was a very playful kind of character, I think, you know what I mean? And he just up for stuff, you know.
Did you get to meet Frank Sidebottom without his head on?
I think I did, actually, But I didn't know, probably. No, I didn't.
He's amazing, Frank Sidebottom. I love all the stories of him. All right, your son Riley is obviously the song you wrote about him, but he's in the band now, which is has been for quite a long time now. This must be quite a cool thing to be in a band with your son.
It is. It's really cool. I mean, it's more like he's helping me out for a bit. Do you know what I mean? I don't feel like, you know, but it is. He's great. He's kind of been. You know, he's really great guitar player, and it's lovely for me having him on stage, and it's made it all a lot more, I enjoy it a lot more.
Really?
Yeah, I think, yeah.
Has he got his own stuff as well he's doing?
He won't play it to me, but I'm sure.
That anxiety thing again.
A very tough audience, you know.
All right, we're coming to the end of the interview now. So have you got any more, how many more hits have you got in you? Are you just going to, do you know when they're coming?
No, I don't think, I don't even know, I'm not sure I know what a hit is anymore, because I think, as you say, everything's changed so much. And I think now, you know, I think I just want, everything's sort of changed. So I think a lot of the time, you know, people put records out almost like as a habit, and it enables you to do a tour, and it becomes a means to an end. And I think that's, in a way, what's, groups are like that now. It's like you've got your corner shop, they're on Facebook building up the face. It's like a small business. Yeah. I hate that, you know, to be honest. I find that the opposite of really what it should be. But that, you know, I think you have to do that probably. But I think for me, I kind of just want to make a record that's got something about it that I'm going to be, that is different to everything, and I'm going to be, and you try and make it good. And I don't know what a hit is, or, you know, and it's like the story about Queen. No one really knows what a hit is. So you just have to try and do something that you are willing to fight the world about. When they tell you it's rubbish, you can honestly say, it's not rubbish. Listen again. And if you feel like that about something and you're willing to fight for it, I think I've always thought that. That's all you can do.
What mistakes do you think people make then when they're writing music, like new bands or people?
I think it's probably me making the mistakes. Do you know what I mean? I do. You know, I think, you know, if you decide to try and write hits, I'm sure it's not hard. I can't imagine that it would be, but it would. I'm not sure. It depends. I wouldn't. You want to be known for the right hits, don't you? You want to, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I think the difficulty is sometimes there's a pressure, and the things you do that you're most proud of aren't the hits, so they're not the thing. You don't put those elements into the one that everyone knows.
Right.
So I think you just have to make sure that you keep putting what you think is special into the tracks you put out, really, I think, because having said that, I realise that even I don't understand what I just said. No one else, let alone anyone else. So I'm going to just stop that line of thought now.
You've been producing for far too long.
I went down a funny road there.
Thinking, if I just say nonsense, then the artists will just go, do it again.
They're not listening.
Just put some more special bits in it. Go on, get back in there and do it again, but make it special.
Yeah. I think what you get from that, which is true, is I haven't got a clue. You know.
Are you going to be producing any more people, do you think?
I very rarely do that. You know, maybe the odd thing, you know, but not much. I think I did my stint at that, and I think I did it at a time when it was more fun than it is now.
Right. Okay. When you look back at your body of work, you must be so immensely proud, are you?
No, I feel like I haven't quite got it yet, to be honest.
No.
I really feel like I just like, if you took any one of my tunes, my records, and you just said, do you think that could be a bit better? And you put it up on the tape, I'd spend another 2 months on it. Because I think it just got to the point where I had to stop. I never quite. Right. But I think that's how you should feel, having said that, because I think that makes you want to do the next one.
Right.
So even though it is a very long time in between, you know, it's over 10 years since I've, you know, finished a new record or anything. But I do think, you know, you have to just, that if you get it right, you may as well just stop. So you're always just not quite getting it and trying to get it.
And do you love gigging now? Do you love being live on stage?
I do. Yeah. Some gigs I don't love, but a lot of them, I love the whole idea of it. You know what I mean? And it's different every time. And it's the most creative situation, isn't it? Because different room, different audience, different reaction. You sing it differently. Something else happens. It's great, you know?
And does it always feel amazing that you got like a handful of records, not even a handful, a load of records that you go, right, I'm playing this. I know, boom, the next one's pure. I know the room's going to come alive because I'm doing some of my hits, you know.
I think sometimes it's more the idea that you might turn up in Austria, in some weird town, and there's a lot of people there who you have nothing in common with. You don't know who they are. It's kind of a winter night. You know, they've all gathered in this place and you play this tune that you wrote in a room in Liverpool. And they get it completely and they know it and they love it. And you think, that's, you know, that, how does that happen? That's fantastic.
I can never understand why some of the big stars just don't play their hits. I just don't get it.
I get it.
Why?
But I think it's about, if you're going to see someone, you want to see them do those tunes.
Do the ones I want, yeah.
So it's about, do you do what the audience want, or do you do what you want? And if you're gonna, you know, it's like Paul Weller doesn't really play jam songs, does he? You know,
yeah.
And I completely get that, because if he does, it's like you've stopped moving forward to a degree and you've gone sideways a little bit. Do you know what I mean? It's like, having said that, I do, but then my band can't break up. It's just me. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? So I feel fine, you know, playing my old tunes, but I kind of get that. You know, whether David Bowie would have wanted to play Space Oddity after having done 14 other albums.
Yeah, okay.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. I'd love to see Weller do jam again, though. Wouldn't we all?
Yeah.
All right, I've got questions we ask everybody, so I'm going to ask them to you. Hopefully you've seen some of these.
I'm not good at these things, so.
Aren't you?
Yeah.
All right. What one piece of advice you'd like to give our listeners that has been invaluable to your life? You don't want to answer any of them, it's fine with us.
No, but if I can, I will. I'm just not very good at on the spot. What piece of advice? You know, I wouldn't know. Just enjoy yourself. That sounds dead trite, but in the end, you've got to try and enjoy yourself, haven't you? Whatever you're doing.
There you go. That's what Suggs said as well.
Oh, okay.
That's
me
good.
And Suggs.
Yeah, well, Suggs. That's what Suggs said. He had that, and his other piece of advice was: whenever you leave the pub. Doesn't matter how you're feeling, always go to the toilet before you leave the pub.
He knows what he's talking about. So
you guys, you'll thank me for that. Always make sure you go just before you leave the pub. But no, he said that. He said that's a really important thing about being in a band.
Sounds a bit trite.
You've got to kind of enjoy yourself.
Yeah. You look back at times and you realise that you might have worried yourself through it and they were the best times. And you think the skill of being able to just to enjoy that moment is, you know, some people are able to do that better than others. And yeah, it's a big thing. You know?
Do you think Morrissey's enjoyed his career?
I'm not sure Morrissey's enjoyed his life, to be fair.
I'm not sure. Whereas I think the Happy Mondays did enjoy themselves, maybe too much at a stage. Right, what's the biggest mistake that you've made? Have you got any of those?
Yeah, I think I've underestimated people sometimes. I have a tendency to underestimate, you know, certain, I'm talking musically, but maybe a bit other stuff as well. Just, you know, I think it's important people will always surprise you. They might surprise you by being horrific, but they'll also surprise you by being great. Mm. And, you know, people can be fantastic. You know what I mean? Mm. And sometimes I lose faith in that a little bit. And I think it's important not to.
Okay. Any life hacks, maybe travel tips or how to give something up, how to clean something like that, a hack?
I don't think so.
You haven't got any.
Traveling for me. I don't like traveling.
Don't you?
I don't like airports. No.
Why?
Well, I'm claustrophobic. So
oh, no.
So it's always tense.
Okay. Can you recommend a book?
Little Prince.
What's that one? I don't know.
The Little Prince. It's a good book. Le Petit Prince.
Okay. What's it about?
Actually, I'll change that to The Old Man and the Sea. I love that.
The Old Man and the Sea.
Hemingway. Okay. That's a very short story. And I think you read it. I found it quite emotionally. It's great.
Uh-huh.
I would recommend it. It takes about 20 minutes to read the whole book and it's brilliant.
Perfect. All right. I'll give that a go. And finally, what's the meaning of life?
An easy one to end with.
Yeah.
I'm not even going to attempt that one, to be fair, you know.
Write some hits. That's a meaning of life. Write some hits. If people want to follow you, Twitter, Ian Z Brody, isn't it?
Or Lightning Seeds is probably a better
idea. Oh, Lightning Seeds. What have you got coming up? Any gigs or anything people can come and see you at? Have you got anything you're going to be doing next year? Or
I'm just finishing my album, actually. Ooh. So after a very long time. So hopefully that'll come out in the new year and then I'll do a tour and, you know, play as much as I possibly can. So
excited.
I'm really excited. I think I've got some good tunes, which has been ages since I felt that way, to be honest, but I really like I think they sound really good, so I'm excited about it.
Is it hard still to motivate yourself to get into a studio and do it?
Not so much to motivate myself, it's just harder to excite myself when I'm doing it, I think, you know.
Okay. And definitely the final question now, Liverpool, is this your year?
Always are.
City are too good, aren't they?
It's always our year, honestly. I love watching them at the moment. I love Klopp. I love watching them. If we win, it's like what I just said about being able to enjoy yourself. I'm enjoying the ride, you know.
I think it's a good time to be a Liverpool fan at the moment.
Honestly,
you've had some bad times with some bad management and some poor decisions made by that football club. Getting Klopp in has just been fantastic for your club. He's the right guy for your club because you're a loyal bunch of fans, love your history, love all that sort of stuff, as we all know. And then you've got the man who's buying into it all as well with you. He's great, isn't he?
No, seriously, I do think that, honestly. I think when it's all not going well, everyone seems to become, you know, you look on Twitter and everything and everyone's obsessed with winning the title and winning the title.
Yeah.
And you see that less and less because it is just great watching them. It's quite exciting. We got runs in the Champions League. It's like a whole thing. And of course you want to win the title.
Yeah.
But I think everyone's aware that it's just great anyway.
And you can buy into your players because he's got some good players, good personalities, good characters. He's sticking with them. You can buy into the manager because he's obviously passionate. Apparently, when he first thing he did when he arrived at the club was going befriend absolutely everyone in the club, from the tea lady, you know, the cliche tea lady thing, but everybody.
Do they have a tea lady? Is that
I don't know. That was, it seems right in Liverpool Football Club, they have a tea lady. Yeah. But apparently he just embraced everyone and he is now Liverpool Football Club. I love it. I think it's absolutely fantastic.
Yeah. And I think also the fact that he's done that in an era when, you know, people go on about, well, the manager's just the coach now. And he's just the coach, but he's still, I don't think that stops you. I think that's an excuse when managers say that. It doesn't stop you putting your personality and stamp on the whole club. You know, even if you are just the coach, you're not having to organise the showers or something. Yeah. You know what I mean? Who wants to do that anyway?
I think it's always telling when you see the post-match interviews with the players. They're buying into Liverpool. And the players haven't done that for quite a long time until Klopp came along. They did a bit, but, you know, obviously Steven Gerrard always did and players like that. But you can see there's the fringes who... All those players want to play for Liverpool now, don't they? He's put Liverpool massively back on the map.
I always, because they're the only two things I know, I always compare football to music.
All right, okay.
And I think there's a certain point with a band where the wind's in your sails.
Yeah.
You know, and it's a great moment. And it's not just about the arrival. It's about that time and everyone's energies. And you get great people contributing and you meet people. And the whole thing takes on an energy. And I think that's where Liverpool is at the moment. And whether they, you know, win the title or whatever, it's still a great thing, you know.
All right, I'm going to ask you one more question. Will we ever win the World Cup?
Will we ever win the World Cup?
I worry it'll ruin everything if we do.
You've got to believe that we will, you know. And we have. You know, we have.
You know, when Johnny Wilkinson, he won the Rugby World Cup, and he always says that he scored the half volley thing, whatever that's called. What is that thing called, the half volley? What's it called? A thingy kick, whatever he did. Drop kick to win the World Cup. And then he went through depression because he'd reached the highest point, and he thought,
what do I do now?
And I worry that if we win the World Cup, the whole country be happy for 48 hours, and then we'll all go, oh God, what do we wish for now?
Yeah, but I'd be happy with that worry, to be fair. It would be a price worth paying.
Hey, listen, thanks so much for coming on the podcast today. I'm really sorry that my presence
thanks for
is,
having me. I'm gonna it's an acquired taste.
Stick some vodka in it. It might be all right. Cheers, Ian. Thanks so much. Sam. Cheers. All right. That was Ian Brody. Thoroughly enjoyed interviewing him. I always like him. Problem with I meet Ian, we just start talking to each other and we don't shut up because there's so much we like talking about with football and music and everything else. The thing I realized from that podcast, though, is how many moments happen in people's lives. What do they call it? Is it sliding door moments? Is that what they call it? What does that actually mean? I don't know what that means.
I don't know. Really. What you need to explain what you're going to say first. Before I can...
Also, he stood in a bus lay-by and it's raining and...
Oh, yes.
Echo and the Bunnymen. Yeah. Ian McCulloch comes past and says, get in there. He listens to it. I've got a few moments with my friends like that of discovering artists when they've got mate of mine got in a car with this guy. He went, listen to this. And went, whoa, I'm signing that tomorrow. That sort of stuff. Right, you've got, and then I won't go into who it was, but it became a huge worldwide star and it's helped make all their careers. All that sort of stuff, which always happens. The, you know, perfect zeitgeist moments as well with the heat wave and the Three Lions this summer and all those type of things. That's what I really gathered from it. It happened with my career. With Soccer AM was just the right time when I got on it. You know, it was 96. It was the World Cup, all that excitement and everything else. And then everyone was really interested in...
That was Euros, wasn't it? 96, yeah.
96, sorry, yeah. And it was just everyone was thoroughly interested in football. And, you know, Sky had come on board a few years before. It was just like, it was just the perfect timing for
You could
things.
Say that. Also, you knew where to be at the right time. And Ian knew where to be at the right time, didn't he? And, you know.
Luck is where preparation meets opportunity, Mark, apparently. The other thing I loved about that podcast was I didn't really know about Big in Japan. And when I started looking into them prior to the interview, and then he started talking about them, the idea that there was a band with Holly Johnson, Bill Drummond in it, and Ian Brody, it's kind of amazing, isn't it? And also Budgie, who talks about the drummer from Susie and the Banshees. It's kind of amazing when you get all that talent together, but they didn't actually do it in that band.
No.
They all went off individually to do stuff.
I'd love to have a nickname like Budgie.
Budgie? Why?
I don't know.
I'm not sure that's a good nickname.
I know, but like we're always, you know, I've always had, I've always been called Org or Augie or, you know.
So, you have?
Yeah, like, because it's the first part of my second name, isn't it? But never Budgie. Budgie's a great nickname.
Okay. Well, I don't know. My nickname's always, well, you know what my nickname is. It's just basically any version of Love Something with insults on it. Always has been. There you go.
Sorry, but back to Big in Japan.
Big in Japan, yeah. Ed, if you ever get a chance, look up Bill Drummond, by the way, KLF, and look at his bit where I think he sort of says the recorded music industry is dead or something. He does this whole lecture, like a TED Talk type scenario. You can see it on YouTube where he explains why music is dead.
I don't want it to be. I don't think I'm going to listen to that.
No, you do. It's quite.
No, I don't want to.
Because it's not true, but it's quite. But it's quite a compelling argument. It's nice to hear different views on things. So. And then he gets involved in his new project. This was a few years ago, actually, I think, when he had a sort of strange choir or something. I can't remember what it was. It was like a choir just making noises. I've got a vague recollection that it all just sort of went, ooh. And he went, listen to the new music. It's quite good. It's quite nuts as well. I quite like the KLF and everything they do, don't you?
I probably won't listen to that.
No, listen to it.
Probably won't, man.
Listen to it.
Yeah, but you know.
Yeah, but I probably won't. Won't, but I probably won't. You're basically saying I'm definitely not.
No,
going
I'm going
to
start.
Don't waste all your time on Netflix.
I'm going to start doing this now. You know when you meet up with a friend and they go, "We really should go for drinking." I'm just going to go, "Yeah, probably
but
won't."
We won't. But we won't. Yeah.
And so when you say to me, "You can't watch that." Okay.
Yeah, but the intention's there, isn't it? When someone says, "Do you want to go for a drink?" There's a bit of you which thinks that's a good idea. And then you realise, which is the point I always make on this podcast, there's not enough time.
No.
There's really not enough time. There's only 24 hours in the day.
But in the back of your head, you do think...
That'd be a nice idea.
But probably won't.
Yeah. Be a nice idea to watch that little YouTube video, Bill Drummond talking about our music industry. If you do get a chance to listen to Bill Drummond talk about it, and you do your opinions, just email us. The email address is dearlovejoypodcast@gmail.com, or you can always tweet me @TimLovejoy. I think that's it, isn't it, for this week's? Anything else to add to it?
No, it's quite nice to talk about Liverpool.
Did you discuss it with him as you left?
Yes.
As
he left? We're quite hopeful, but Man City are going to win, aren't they?
Oh, of course. Yeah. But they can't...
I mean, it doesn't really fit. It's not really in line with your predictions at the beginning of the season, Tim.
What were those?
Chelsea would win.
Well, that's this prediction every season.
You never put Liverpool in the top four. Is that just to piss off Rimmer?
And you and everybody else that I know who's a Liverpool fan. But I think Man City will win it easily this season. But next season, I think they're going to struggle because no teams ever win it 3 years in a row, do they?
They could be the first.
Do they? Has any team won it 3 seasons in a row?
There's a great video about with Bill Drummond saying that football's dead. You should watch it. Football's dead.
Right, I'm going to quit. Right, how long has this podcast been going on for? Is it far too long?
It's not as long as our normal ones. We've been banging on the door 2 hours on some of them, haven't we?
Tim is Googling on the internet, looking for information to fill up his head. To fill up his head, or just to fill up the time. Whoever get the feeling, he's wasting yours and mine. Oh no, no, no.
Okay, this is bizarre when I talk about football because I'm very wrong, and I'm never wrong.
Not on any subject, I would say.
The one thing about me which everyone should know is I might not always be right, but I'm never wrong. No, but I'm never wrong on football, and I've always got a great memory, and I always know my facts for everything. So teams that have won it 3 times in a row, let's go top flight, shall we? Huddersfield Town did it 23-26. You got... the great Arsenal team of 32-35. That's 1932-35. Then you've got, you're going to have your mob, aren't you? 81-84, the Liverpool boys. And then it goes into the Premier League, doesn't it? And when you hit the Premier League, you've got United, who won it 1998 to 2001, and then they did it again 2006 to 2009, three times in a row.
So apart from all those ones,
no team has ever won it
ever
three times in a row. So City can't win it next year.
So good.
I might stick some money on City winning next year. They're so good at the moment, aren't they? They've reached perfection, really.
Right, yeah, and I think it's gone over the hill and is now boring.
No.
Do you know what I mean? It was so great watching them last season, and now it's just like again. Of course, they're going to win.
Yeah,
there's no point televising those.
But there's always the demise. Chelsea were good like that one stage, weren't we? Liverpool were great in the 80s, as you know. It always changes, Mark. That's the great thing about football. United used to dominate for years and years.
You should watch that Peter Beardsley thing about how football's dead, though, on YouTube.
Oh, yeah. Phil Drummond, watch it.
Bill Drummond?
What did I call him? Phil Drummond. There you go. I never make mistakes. Right, that's it. I'm running out of energy and I'm making myself look really stupid. So I'm finishing now.
I am helping you.
Yeah. We'll be back very soon. For the time being, peace and love, Joy.
Bye.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.